come now to our 77th study on the Arkansas Camping 1918, and this brings us to number 21 in our series on the Book of Daniel. We have been studying so far the parallel between the days of the 490 years and, of course, the present time down here in this world's history. I meant to mention today earlier, but I failed to do so, that the 2,300 days, if you look very carefully, unites the starting point, that is this starting point, 457 BC, it unites that particular point with 144. So that in 1844, at the end of the 2,300 days, we come back to the same point of time as marked the beginning of the 2,300 days. You see that? In other words, in 457 BC, the church stood there exactly at the same spot there as they again stood in 1844. Same place precisely. The same captivity behind them, the same work of God ahead of them, and the same wonderful and marvelous day of opportunity. Now, we said earlier, of course, that to understand what God will do at this present time, namely down here in 1918, we have but to go back and see what God did in this previous occasion, namely when Christ was upon this earth. How did the God of heaven cope with that particular problem? We only have to read the history book, of course, to find out. In fact, we don't even need to read the history book because we know already the way in which the God of heaven approached that problem back there. God sent a messenger with a message. First of all, John the Baptist, and then Jesus Christ, and then the apostles, three successive groups of messengers. And those messengers brought a message to the people of that time. That was the solution that God provided. Now, the result of that message was a separation. There was a majority under the leadership of the ministry who flatly and even violently rejected the message sent to them from heaven. A little company, on the other hand, accepted that very, very wonderful life which God gave at that particular point of time. Let's write down the word here, little company, predominantly made up, of course, of the 12 apostles together with certain other followers at that point of time. Now, that little company gained three very important and precious acquisitions from the teachings of Jesus Christ. And the first of those three acquisitions was personal victory over the sin problem. Secondly, it brought them into a very wonderful experience of unity. And thirdly, of course, it effected a separation between them and those who had rejected the message. Personal victory, a collective unity, and total separation from those who had been putting stones into their temple structure. Now, when those three things had been achieved, the royal company had gained victory, unity, and separation, then what followed? The mighty outpouring of the former rain. So then came that wonderful gift, the former rain upon them as they gained those three precious and wonderful gifts at that point of time. Now, will God work any differently at the present time? Is God working the same way already at the present time? In other words, into the awesome darkness of this great apostasy, has God in his great goodness, even at this very time, sent to us a living, saving, separating message? He certainly has. Now, are we finding that as a result, the majority led by the ministry are rejecting this message? As it was, so it is. And do we find that there is a little company around the world who are accepting this wonderful truth? Again, as it was, so it is. And do we find that basic, or the very first thing that the real believers in this message obtain is a personal experience of victory over the sin problem? Now, I know tonight if I was to invite you folks, that quite a number could stand up and tell how your life has been transformed by the living power of God as you have applied the principles of this message. There are some, of course, perhaps who can't relate to this experience yet, but I know that many in this room could do so, and around the world, of course, there's a large number of people now who would testify that living experience of victory over sin. Of course, we must appreciate the fact that there has to be foolish virgins amongst us, because the prophecy says there will be, right down to the end of the harvest. And a foolish virgin is a person who has failed to gain for himself the precious oil in his lamp, the oil being the Holy Spirit, and therefore does not know the personal living experience of victory over sin. And when pressure and test is brought, then these folk, of course, are unable to maintain their place in the movement. Now, secondly, do we find that there is a very precious and wonderful spirit of unity developing in this movement? It's very wonderful, isn't it? I remember a few years ago that we had various difficult questions and problems that kind of broke up the unity somewhat, but lately, over the past 2 or 3 years, particularly since the present face and the character of God, the unity amongst this people has been really beautiful and really marvelous. And thirdly, do we find that here we have a group experiencing total separation in the most complete sense of the word from the apostate people who have joined in with the Babylon today? And the answer is yes. Now, as we come into a closer and deep experience in these three things, what is the certain follow-on that must come next? The latter rain, right? There must and there will come the latter rain. And as that latter rain fell upon the little company back, as the former rain fell upon that little company back there, so the latter rain will fall on the little company today. And what will the latter rain bring? It will bring the finishing of the work at last in this age and generation. Let's look now at what I class here as being, we call this study actually the 2 days of opportunity, 2 great days of opportunity. Now let's appreciate first of all the fact it takes God time and the expenditure of much effort on the part of human messengers, on the part of angel ministers, on his own part, on Christ's part, and on the part of the Holy Spirit to bring about a day of opportunity. Now, was it possible for the Church of God, while they were enslaved in Babylonian captivity, was it possible for the Church at large at that time to make an end of sin and bring an everlasting righteousness? It wasn't really, even though Daniel and his 3 friends certainly did marvelously well in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't possible for the entire Church to do that during their period of captivity. And so God labored to bring them out and set them free and give them back their own country. It took time to rebuild the temple, to reestablish the daily and maintain the freedom of God's people. Now, it didn't take, of course, 490 years for them to finish the work of righteousness, even though God allowed them that much time which to do it. But very, very quickly, of course, the work could have been finished. Now, when they lost their day of opportunity by failing to come into line with God, because they were their own plan makers, and they allowed Satan with his various devices to come in and lead them astray, then there followed centuries of apostasy. It took hundreds of years before the papacy came to rule the world. But most certainly, of course, the Church of God cannot finish her appointed task while they are slipping into a deeper and deeper apostasy, can they? That's an impossibility. And certainly during the 1260 years, when they were locked in very, very great darkness, they didn't know about the Sabbath, didn't know about the sanctuary, didn't know about many, many great truths that we know about today, and so the work could not be finished during those days. And so we can only write the word delay over this long period, right? Delay. Then God broke the power of Babylon, brought his people out, gave them the sanctuary truths, the daily and their personal freedom, the marvelous gospel, the first and second and third angels' messages, and how quickly they might have finished the work and brought an end to sin and brought in everlasting righteousness. But once again, they failed. So now notice something. Just notice something. God said in regard to the 490 years, I have given you that time in which to do it. He did not say they would do it in that period of time. And God, knowing they would not do it then, unto 2,300 days, That is, when another day of opportunity starts, he said, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed or restored to its rightful state. And in Revelation 10, we're told, in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God shall be finished. It shall be finished. Now, when God foresaw the failure of this first great day of opportunity, then he foretold a second day of opportunity. But where in the Word of God does he speak about a third day of opportunity? He doesn't speak about that. So put these three things together. No third day of opportunity is mentioned in the Scriptures anywhere. And twice God said, once in Daniel 8:14 and once in Revelation 10, he said in Daniel 8:14, under 2,700 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And Revelation 10, then in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, the mystery of God shall be finished. God never said that about the 490 years, did he? But he does say it about this. So what does that tell us with great certainty? This time the work is going through. This time it will be finished. This time at last we've come to that time when Daniel shall truly stand in his lot at the end of the days in the person of people who will live for God as faithfully and completely as he did, and thus God at last will have the army for whom he can finish the work. That's rather encouraging, isn't it? As we said the other night, I'm very, very impressed, of course, with this thought that the very same work that God did through Jeremiah in the preparation of Daniel and his friends for their Babylonian captivity, or I should better say their Babylonian triumph, God, through this message, is doing for us at this present time. Now, we might not be able to see too distinctly in ourselves much progress being made, but progress is being made. We are learning. There is a development of character. A great work is being done in those of us who fully and simply receive this great message. There are, of course, many evidences that can divert our minds from the truth, the weakness and frailties of each other, and so forth. We should take our minds off those things and fix them upon the great message that God has been to us at the present time. Now, I personally was very discouraged a few years ago, as it seemed as if the message wasn't doing very much for us as a people. But that discouragement had been replaced by tremendous courage on my part, because as I travel the world, I can see the dramatic change in the people of God over the past couple of years in particular. Ever since God gave to us the message on his character, that was a great turning point in our lives, and what a difference that's made to the experience of so many people around the world, as we can see with our own eyes, as we hear by their wonderful confessions of these changes. But now there comes a problem in regard to Daniel 8:14. Let's go back to it, and we'll now look at this text in relationship to the question which is raised, and which question is answered by the 14th verse in the 2,300 days, and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now I'm going to be very particular that you understand the problem that we'll discuss in this particular verse. So I hope you pay very close attention. And I'm going to be particular about this because I know that this is the best argument, the most effective argument that our enemies can use against our position, or the Advent position on Daniel 8 verse 14. Now I was a student, of course, in the Australasian Missionary College quite a number of years ago. I studied both Bible doctrines and Bible prophetics, in both of which subjects Daniel 8:14 was studied. I've heard many Adventist preachers proclaiming the Advent message since that time and before it, but I can't ever recall a single teacher in Bible class or a single evangelist or Seventh-day Adventist minister ever connecting Daniel 8:14 as the answer to the question posed back in Daniel chapter 8 verse 13. But how can we do that? How can we separate an answer from its question? If we find that the Bible asks the question, and let's read that question in verse 13, the question is, how long? That's the question. How long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? How long? And what's the answer? 2,300 days. Now, if the 2,300 days is the answer to that question, then must we not say that the answer in relationship to the question, mustn't we? You can't separate them under any circumstances. All right, then. Now, our enemies have noted this, and they're very, very quick to point out some apparent inconsistencies or mistakes in the interpretation of Daniel 8:14 as adopted by Adventists from the beginning of their history. Now, listen very carefully, because before I start to raise this problem, I want to assure you that nobody in the world more emphatically believes that the 2,300 days began in 457 B.C. and ended in 1844 than I do myself. Now, you may get the impression as I propound the arguments of our enemies that I don't believe that. But let me assure you, in the strongest possible terms, that I believe that the 2,300 days began back in 457 B.C. and ends in 1844. And you saw the diagram on the board to confirm that fact. So here we go back, I'll put it up here rather. Here we go to 457 B.C. and the 2,300 days extends over here to 1844 with the 1260 years, of course, from 538 to 1798 enclosed within that prophetic period. And, of course, the 70 weeks or 490 years extending down here to A.D. 34. If you haven't noticed it before, it's worth your while to notice right now that all the time prophecies of Daniel and the Revelation are enclosed within the 2,300-day prophetic period. They're all enclosed inside that long span of time. All right, then. Now that you heard me plainly say that I fully believe that is the truth on this question, I'll now raise an argument which apparently destroys that position I have outlined there on the blackboard. And because you're going to face this argument in the very near future as you preach the final message, it is a very good thing that you be equipped to face it by understanding the answers to the question which we raised against us in the final battle. Now then, I'm going to ask you some questions now. Put you on the spot just a little bit, perhaps. It says in verse 13, how long shall be the vision concerning the valley and the transgressive desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Now, in the previous verses, who are we told would tread down the sanctuary and the host? Not the beast. Speak up loud and clear. I can't hear for the fans. Right, the little horn. And who do we believe the little horn represents? Right, the papacy. Also pagan Rome, but in particular, of course, the papacy. Now, in relationship to our chart over here, let's start putting some other dates in now. Here we have 457 B.C. And if we go back here to 538, we have, of course, the end of the Babylonian Empire. And from 538 down to 331, somewhere about here, we have Medo-Persia. And from 331 to 168 B.C., we have Grecia. And then Rome comes upon the scene in 168 B.C. and goes across to 476 A.D. And 538, of course, we have the papal power coming upon the scene and reigning for 1260 years until 1798. Now, we've established the fact that that power which was to and actually did take away the deity and tread down the sanctuary was the papacy in particular, and of course it also included papal Rome, pagan Rome. So then, after telling us in those verses that pagan and papal Rome would tread down the sanctuary, then the question comes, how long would this be done? And the answer, 2,300 days. Now our enemies say to us, all right, the little horn power would do it, and the little horn power does not even come into power till 168 B.C., so how can you start the 2,300 days, which is the duration of time during which the little horn power would tread down the sanctuary and the host? How can you start that period hundreds of years before the little horn power even appeared upon the earth? You see the argument? You really see it? Pardon? Okay, we'll repeat it, because I don't want to go past it until you really understand it. Well, there's some of you can already see it, but not all. Now, look, this red line there is from where the 2,000 Genoa day start, and we go right down to 168 BC, and that is where Rome came upon the scene. Now, could Rome cast down the sanctuary and tread down the people of God before she even existed? She couldn't, could she? All right then. And yet the 2,300 days is the duration of time during which the little horn power, our enemies argue, would tread down the sanctuary and take away the darling. Therefore, they say, the very earliest date that it starts the 2,300 days would be 168 BC. That's the earliest date. But then, of course, the question arises, did Rome take away the daily on that exact day? When we get to Revelation 12, we'll demonstrate that the Bible says the daily was taken away in 508 AD. 508 AD. And if you add 2,300 years to that, where do you end up? At 2,808 AD, which of course is still another 828 years to go yet. Is that a very encouraging prospect? Now, can you see the argument? You see the problem? It's quite a sticky one, isn't it? How many of you would like to be faced with that at this moment by a very, very clever theologian from one of the other churches? And yet the answer is surprisingly simple. Yes, right, but it says that a little horn power is wanting to do it, right? Now, what I've done and what they'll do to you too is to beg a certain question. They make an assumption, and you accept the assumption all too easily because it seems to be so strongly suggested. Now, let's read verse 13 again. I'm going to add the words into that verse which are not written there, but which we assume are there. Verse 13, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host of God under foot by the little horn power. Now, were those last few words there? Did we assume that they were there before? Did we? We did, didn't we? Yeah, right. Because in the previous few verses it talks about the little horn power doing it, we naturally assume the question concerns the little horn power doing it and nobody else but the little horn power doing it. Right? Now that is where their argument carries weight. But the moment that we deny that this question is limited to the little horn power alone, and look at the question in its broader aspects, in its full scope, the problem disappears completely. Now then, we'll go back through history a little bit further. I'll take now the book Prophets and Kings, and in the introductory chapter, a chapter you do well to read very carefully from beginning to end, we have a chapter called The Vineyard of the Lord. And this chapter is concerning the purpose that God had for Israel, which purpose, of course, was instituted right back in the days of Abraham when God said, in thee, or in thy seed, shall all nations of the earth be blessed. So I read now on page 15. It was for the purpose of bringing the best gifts of heaven to all the peoples of earth that God called Abraham out from his idolatrous kindred and bade him dwell in the land of Canaan. Note that it was for the purpose of bringing the best gifts of heaven to all the peoples of the earth that God called Abraham. Going a bit further across, it talks about the vineyard of the Lord, page 18. Now, I'd like to read the whole chapter, but I must guard my time a little bit because the week is almost gone. To this people were committed the oracles of God. They were hedged about by the precepts of his law, the everlasting principles of truth, justice, and purity. Obedience to these principles was to be their protection, for it would save them from destroying themselves by sinful practices. And as the tower in the vineyard, God placed in the midst of the land his holy temple. Christ was their instructor, as he had been with them in the wilderness, so he is still to be their teacher and guide. In the tabernacle and the temple, his glory dwelt in the holy Shekinah above the mercy seat. In their behalf, he constantly manifested the riches of his love and patience. Next page, on page 19, I read, the children of Israel were to occupy all the territory which God had appointed them. those nations that rejected the worship and service of the true God were to be dispossessed. But it was God's purpose that by the revelation of his character through Israel, men should be drawn unto him. To all the world, the gospel invitation was to be given. Through the teaching of the sacrificial service, Christ was to be uplifted before the nations, and all who would look unto him should live. All who, like Rahab the Canaanite and Ruth the Moabite test, turn from idolatry to the worship of the true God would unite themselves with his chosen people. As the numbers of Israel increased, they were to enlarge their borders until their kingdom should embrace the world. That was the original plan. And right back in Abraham's day, and onward, I like to choose Joshua's day in particular because Paul says in Hebrews, the 4th chapter, if Joshua had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day, that is, day of opportunity, saying in David, today if you'll hear his voice after so long a time, harden not your hearts and so forth. So we'll go back to the days of Joshua. God had brought Israel out of the land of Egypt. He'd given them possession of the promised land and set before them the task of occupying the entire world with righteous people. Now then, there were three facilities that Israel had to have in order to accomplish their task. Number one, they had to be a free people. Because if they're in bondage to an overruling power, they must do the will of the power that they're serving. They can't do the will of God. Secondly, they had to have the dialect. And thirdly, they must have the sanctuary. And of course, they must have, obviously, Jesus Christ as their connector, plan maker, problem solver, burden bearer, and so forth. Now, in the book of Daniel chapter 8, you'll notice that the little horn tower, they trod down the host, they took away the daily, they cast down the sanctuary, and they exalted themselves to an equality with Jesus Christ. Now, by so doing, by doing all those things, Satan spiked the guns of God's people. In other words, Satan scattered the power of the holy people by doing those very things. Now, obviously, of course, when the people of God were equipped with all that, when they were free people, they had the daily services which brought them the living power of God, they had the sanctuary of truth, and they had Jesus Christ as their plan maker, they could not fail. Well, they had those things and lived by those things. But as you know, of course, in our previous study, they themselves turned aside from Christ being their full and only plan maker. They put themselves as plan makers in Christ's place, and every time they did, they lost their freedom because their enemies came in, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, and so forth. They came in and took away their freedom. And then they took away the daily. Think of Gideon's day, for instance. When Gideon wanted to offer sacrifice, was there a regular daily sacrificial system being conducted in Israel at that time? Or did he have to creep down behind a wine press and secretly offer his little offering? Right? And what about the sanctuary in Gideon's day? And who was the plan maker in Gideon's day? Okay? So, starting back in Joshua's day, immediately after Joshua's death, we find that Israel falls into apostasy, and when they did, they lost their freedom, they lost the daily, the sanctuary was trodden down, and Jesus Christ was replaced by a power which magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And then God came back through a great deliverer such as Jephthah, Barak, Deborah, Gideon, Samson, and so forth. In turn, and we find that here we come up and down, up and down, up and down through the period of the judges. And you take the trouble and you'll find that every single time that the enemy came, they trod down the host, took away the daily, cast down the sanctuary and replaced Christ for themselves. Every time. And every time that God restored them, Christ was put back in his rightful place, the sanctuary was restored to its rightful state, the daily reinstituted and God's people were free. Finally, we come down to David's day, when another wonderful day of opportunity was offered to the people of God. And in David's day, the Church of God rose to the highest levels of promise back in those days. After David's death, Solomon built that magnificent temple, the pride, glory of Israel's entire history. But Solomon sowed some fearful seeds of apostasy by his rather immoral living. And the result was that after his death, the kingdom was divided between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And there came this long, sad apostasy down until around about 608 or 606 B.C., Babylon rose up to rule the world. And what did Babylon do? Babylon took away their freedom, took away the daily, cast down the sanctuary and put themselves in the place of Jesus Christ. Now, looking back over centuries of time, what was the picture which Daniel saw? A picture of the man of sin over and over and over again doing these things to God's people and thus scattering their power and making it impossible for the work of God to be finished. And then in Daniel chapter 8, God showed to Daniel the rise of Medo-Persia, the rise of Greece, the rise of pagan Rome, the rise of papal Rome. And so as Daniel takes his eyes off the past and looks into the future, what does he see? What does he see? Exactly the same thing all over again. Now Daniel knew, as very few men have ever known, that the work of God can never be finished by a bound people who do not have the daily, where the sanctuary is cast down and the man of sin replaces Christ. The work of God can never be finished under those conditions. So Daniel knew that someday, if God's work was to be ever completed, this pattern must be broken. There had to come a time when never again, note those words, when never again could the man of sin take away our freedom, rob us of the daily, cast down the sanctuary, put himself in the place of Jesus Christ. Now until that time came, when forever Rome's power to do that was broken, the work of God could not be finished. So can't you understand then how the anguish cried out from Daniel as he looked back on this long, sad pattern of the past and saw this same pattern revealed in the future? What would he naturally say? How long? Right? How long? So that question was not asked in the context of the small section occupied by the little horn power. The question was asked in the context of the whole great long span of history. The context of a work which ought to have been finished by that time but wasn't. In the context of a work which ought to have been finished in the immediate future but would not be. For centuries and centuries and centuries of time. And in the context of all that comes the question, how long? And the answer, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. We've established already from Daniel chapter 9, of course, that 2,300 days began in 457 B.C. and it ends down here in 1844. Now then, from 1844 till the present time, we have seen something like 136 years go by. 136 years of time have gone by since 1844. Now, during those 136 years, the peculiar people, namely the Seventh Adventist Church, to whom God personally gave all these things, their freedom, the daily, the sanctuary, and Jesus Christ as their head, have gone into apostasy of great depth. They still have their personal physical freedom, but not their spiritual freedom. They have completely lost sight of the daily. They no longer have the sanctuary message, and Jesus Christ is not their plan maker. Would you agree? Right? And all those things we have to agree. Now, usually, down here in the past, when Israel at large lost those things, they became lost to everybody, excepting perhaps for a scattered remnant, but they still became lost to everybody because everybody lost their freedom and there were no daily sacrifices at the sanctuary and the building itself was cast down and somebody else ran the country apart from Jesus Christ. But when the Adventist Church apostatized, a very, very wonderful thing happened, which of course we witnessed to this very night. And that wonderful thing is that there rose up a people out of that apostasy, namely ourselves, who have a living grasp of the sanctuary truth and a personal physical and spiritual freedom, to know the power of the daily, and as perhaps few other people have ever done, look to Jesus Christ as their only plan maker. Now, since 1844, and you think about this yourself, since 1844, Have the true people of God ever gone back into bondage under Roman power? Have they lost the veiling, that wonderful day-by-day provision that God has for his people? No. Has the sanctuary been taken away from them? No. And is Christ today the true head of his true church? Right. And so the prophecy is being fulfilled. Now, just as surely as in 1844, we come to that point of time.